Welcome to the Nerd Journey Podcast. Our goal is to help you, the technology professional, accelerate your career progression, increase your job satisfaction, and be more effective in your existing role.
We want to bring listeners like you the career advice we wish we'd been given earlier in our careers.
I'm John White at VJourneyman on Twitter, sharing co-host duties with Nick Cordy at NetworkNerd _.
We're two former IT operations guys who have moved on to pre-sales roles with technology vendors. We have our opinions, but we also like to highlight the journeys of others and see what we can learn from them.
We'd also like to ask for your feedback to make this a conversation, not a one-way broadcast. Email us at nerdjourneypodcast@gmail.com or DM us at nerdjourney on Twitter. So come join us on our nerd journey.
Let's take a trip. You're listening to episode 267, Let's Go. Our guest this week is Eric Gross. He's a technologist, an entrepreneur, and the co-founder of the Tech Academy. This is an organization that's helping people of various skills and backgrounds gain the experience and knowledge they need to break into a technology career. As you listen to part one of the discussion with Eric, there is certainly a theme of learning within a number of different environments, and Eric's going to reflect on those experiences and how they impacted him at that time, as well as how he might carry those experiences and the lessons learned forward to present day. The first environment you'll hear about in this discussion is Eric learning from perhaps his favorite teacher, his father. Then Eric chose to go into the Navy and be a part of the nuclear engineering program. He had to learn how to be a student as well as an instructor. And once Eric decided to get out of the Navy, he went into sales. Not only did he learn business operations and how to be a successful franchisee, he also learned when it was time to leave his job and pursue something else. Let's catch the full story. Here's part one of our discussion with Eric Gross. Eric Gross, welcome to Nerd Journey.
Thank you, man. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, likewise. It's going to be a great conversation. Let's start by having you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do today.
I'm a senior technologist. I've got three principal activities. I am a cloud transformation consultant. I help run a software developer bootcamp, and I consult technology entrepreneurs on building scalable businesses.
Oh, man, that's a big portfolio of work that I'm sure takes a lot of great time management skills, which we can definitely dig into as we continue our conversation. But nobody starts there, Eric. I think if I recall, back at the beginning of your career, you served in the Navy. Is that right?
Yeah, I got out of high school and went into the Navy nuclear power program, which was an odd move for a lot of my friends to see because I grew up in Northern California, in the middle of the woods, son of hippies. I decided to go into the nuclear engineering program in the Navy. But yeah, that's where my technology education began formally. But in terms of my love of tech, it actually started when I was 11, when my dad bought a VIC-20 that I have no idea how he could afford because we did not have a lot of money. He had programmed IBM mainframes in the 60s, and they would sit around and just have these jam sessions about what it'd be like if we get these things small enough someone could have one at their desk. And so when the home computers came out, he lost it. Right, he bought one right away, and he did something that changed my life. He brought it home, he plugged it into the TV. That was your monitor back then, as some of our listeners know. And so he plugged it into the TV, and he showed me how to like boot it up and some little applications on it and a little disk drive and how you put stuff in and everything. That was all cool. He said, that's not the cool part. And he unplugged it, turned it over, pulled out a screwdriver, and popped off the back. And then over the next hour or so, he proceeded to teach me everything about the fundamentals of the internals of a computer. This is the CPU. It has an instruction set that's built into it. Those instructions are written in binary in a certain pattern. This is how binary works. This is how the CPU communicates via these wires to the keyboard, over to the display to the, you know, the TV, over to pull in data from the disk drive, everything.
Oh, that's a masterclass.
Oh, yeah. Every bit of mystery about computers was removed for me in like an afternoon. My dad's a very patient, phenomenal teacher. And that's where the journey really began. Of course, I'm 11 years old. I'm not working professionally as a developer. So yeah, in terms of technology, yeah, it started in the Navy.
So what generated the interest in the nuclear program specifically? Was that something you had been exposed to, something you were encouraged to pursue by a member of the family or something like that?
I was encouraged by an overeager Navy recruiter. I appreciate to this day, but no, I was looking to go into the Navy because quite honestly, while I'm reasonably bright, my grades in high school did not reflect that at all. In fact, we'll jump forward a second. I'm in nuclear power school in Orlando, you know, in the late 80s. And we learned about something called the neutron yield for fission of uranium-235. In other words, if you take uranium-235 and you hit it really hard with a neutron, more than one neutron comes out of it. That's how you get chain reactions, right? Specifically, 2.43 neutrons on average come out of the uranium. Why is that significant? That was my GPA in high school. So I am living proof that early performance grade-wise doesn't necessarily mean everything about your future career trajectory. But yeah, back to why even the Navy or why the nuclear power part of it. I scored really well on that test they do, the ASVAB, right? And I saw a gleam in the eyes of the recruiter at my high school when he saw my test scores and said, I have another test for you. And he gave me some math and science test. To this day, I don't know how well I really did on it. I think I was really on the cusp. And I'm not saying they fudged the numbers, but I did get into the new program and it changed my life. So no, it was not originally what I was intending, but the things I learned on that program, I use them every day now, decades later.
Oh, wow. So a program like that, do you sign up for a specific amount of time you're going to be in the service to in return for participating in the training involved in a program like that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. A normal enlistment is 4 years and it was minimum was 6 years to go into the nuke power program. But when they went over what they were going to train me on, it was a no-brainer. I mean, I didn't think I was college material at the time, and they're going to train me in electronics, physics, nuclear engineering, heat transfer and fluid flow, chemistry, higher math. Like, it went on and on and on. I'm like, okay, yeah, 2 years of schooling and then 4 years out in the fleet. Yeah, okay, good. That sounds good.
Was it the technology training that tipped the scales for you since you kind of had an influence there at an early age, or just the total package?
No, it was technology. Absolutely. I was just talking to my wife about this the other day. Some of the fondest moments I have are sitting down with my dad, and he would buy these build-it-yourself kits from a company called Heathkit. I think they're still around. But that's how our shortwave radio, you know, our ham radio at that house got put together, is he bought a kit, and he and I built it component by component, bought the antenna and attached it to the house, set up the shortwave receiver transmitter. And all of a sudden, my dad's talking to people in Eastern Europe, which early 80s, you're not supposed to do, as far as I knew. I'm watching the news. I'm like, are we really allowed to talk to these folks? This is amazing, you know? So yeah, from a very early age, anything technology related, anything logic problem related was just, I would eat it up.
Was the program you got into what you thought it would be when you signed up for it? You know, sometimes we can pursue something, whether it's in military service or in a job, where we have this idea about what it's going to be, and then there is the state of what it actually is. Did those line up to meet your expectations?
It's an interesting question. I haven't looked at that. I can tell you that as a young 18-year-old idiot kid, I had an idea of what it might be like, but very little reality. My dad was in the service. He was in the Navy, served in Vietnam and Gulf of Tonkin and all that. And my grandfather was in the Navy. He was a pharmacist. And so I had a little bit of idea of kind of what the culture might be like. But again, I'm 18, right? I will say that in terms of the technology aspect of it, what they laid out is what I got to experience. They really communicated that part of it well. The actual culture of being in the service, that's an adjustment. I don't care who you are. Like, that is an adjustment. But the level of professionalism, discipline, communication required to operate successfully in that environment, that I didn't know was coming. And I found very helpful. And it was quite the adjustment when I got out of the service to be in civilian world.
What was the biggest challenge / adjustment going in? You listed several things, but which of those was the hardest thing for you? Was it the discipline? Was it something else? Strict scheduling?
No, I do well when I'm run. I don't have a real big problem with, you know, being directed and controlled, right? As long as I have a lot of faith and respect in whoever might be leading me, right? So that wasn't that big of an issue. And for the most part, it's a sane organization. That part of it was pretty good. I tell you, the part that was the most difficult to experience, but led to one of the most important transformations for me, both as a human and then as a technologist, is a point about a month and a half into nuclear power school. So like to set the stage, you go through 2 months of boot camp, which is everything you see in the movies. It's not a lot of fun, right? But then I went to 6 months of electronics school. And of course, it's Navy hours. So 6 months is about a year and a half worth of education anywhere else, right? You're 60, 70 hours a week, and that's all you're doing because they own you, right? So I got done with that 6 months of electronics school, and I did pretty well there. But then we hit nuclear power school, and about a month in, we hit higher math. I did not do well in math in high school. It was not my subject. And so about a month and a half in, I'm really starting to feel pressure and not doing well. And here's what the pressure looked like. I'll just be completely frank about it. The school I went to, the Naval Nuclear Propulsion School, was then and is now rated as the most difficult academic school to go through in the military. It has the highest dropout rate. It actually had a non-zero suicide rate. It was rough for a lot of people, okay? And if you didn't make it through there, you were still on the hook for 6 years, but you're probably going to end up, not there's anything wrong with it, going down to be like a, you know, chipping paint off the side of walls or being a damage control man and that kind of stuff. Again, vital roles, but it's not what you came in for. So I was really feeling the pressure. And there was a couple moments there where I'm like, I don't know if I can actually do this. And so I had to really look inside myself and decide, what do you do when you get knocked down? How tough are you? And again, I'm an 18-year-old kid, right? And I decided there was no way I was giving up. And I pushed through and actually mastered that. And now I actually love math. But that was a rough, rough moment for me. A couple of weeks there, actually.
And did the instructors provide any kind of encouragement, at least for those who could see that you might be struggling a little bit? Or was it really you had to self-motivate?
It was a bit of a combination. I mean, it's not a sink or swim kind of an approach because they're investing a ton into people. They already know they tested well. And as long as you are like playing by the rules and not going out and getting drunk every night and being an idiot, right? They do want you to get through it. But they also know that you've got to have that, some of that just internal drive. And so it was a balance. Generally, what they would do is if you were kind of struggling a little bit, yeah, they'd apply a little bit of soft skills, but mainly they'd say, okay, you're in here 50 hours a week already, just regular Monday through Friday classes. You now have to put in an extra 25 to 30 hours after class. Just like that's how they do it. They would just keep you heads down in the material. And for a lot of people, it worked. We didn't have a real, like in the group that I was in, we didn't have a real big dropout rate.
Once you had finished all your training, did you go and get stationed at a specific power plant or on a submarine? Or
I didn't. And it was actually a really cool thing that happened in my life that I didn't. I'd never saw it coming. The way the sequence works is you do that electronics school, then you go to nuclear propulsion school, and then they send you to what they call nuclear prototype. And these are actual working nuclear reactors stationed, you know, at different points in the country where they have, again, operating nuclear reactors, but they're not at sea. Mine, for example, was out in the desert in Idaho. They had an actual submarine there out in the middle of the desert in Idaho. And right next door to us, they had 1/4 of an aircraft carrier's nuclear power plant, right? And this is a chance for you to take all that theoretical knowledge you just got crammed into you over a year or longer and do all of your practical drills. Start up the nuclear reactor, shut down the nuclear reactor, operate the electrical generation distribution equipment, operate all the hydraulic equipment. You know, take time on the throttle that, you know, controls how fast you go through the water, which, by the way, is pretty funny because there was no water and there was no screw at the back of the submarine. They had a huge giant box that simulated the resistance of a propeller moving through the water, which was pretty wild. It's like an artificial ocean in the box, we called it. But the point is, this is where you get a chance to actually apply these things, get your hands dirty with them, and everything kind of comes together. And in fact, there's two really key things that came out of that that influenced just the fact that I teach now and how I seek to help people when I teach. So you have this big book you're given when you arrive there, and you got a 6-month program. It's self-paced. You know, if you're aggressive, you want to get through it faster, but you have this big book, and in it are about 400 individual different items you need to do to check off practical work on every aspect of this boat. And the pattern of how you'd learn individual systems is relatively the same. You'd have to be able to draw the diagram out on paper, and then you'd go through the boat and you'd physically trace it, usually with your hands, like where is all the piping routing or the electrical conduit, or, you know, you want to put your hands on this stuff as much as you can. And I'd been there about a month and a half, 2 months, and I'd done this for a handful, maybe 15 or 16 of the 70 or 80 systems you needed to study. And I'll never forget this moment. I learned each of these systems prior to this almost in a vacuum. You're learning this particular electrical system, this particular like plumbing system, and so on and so forth, right? And I'm tracing this really simple system. I believe it was a pure water storage system, big old tank, pipes, valves, pumps, right? But I'm tracing it, like putting my hands on the pipes where I can, moving around and like trying to grasp this one system. And I was at this bulkhead, this is a wall, right? But this bulkhead, and where the pipe for this system that I'm studying is going through the wall, right near it, a whole bunch of other things going through the wall, electrical conduit and a bunch of other stuff. And I remember looking at what I'm studying and all these things right next to it going through the wall. And all of a sudden, this mental shift happens where I realized that not only did I know what almost all of those other things penetrating the wall were related to, what systems they were part of, but I saw how all of the systems I'd studied so far were actually interrelated, where they actually met and how one could affect the other. And all of a sudden my mind snapped open and I got a grasp of the whole system. I stood there for probably a good 20, 30 seconds, just mind going off. And from that point forward, every new system I'd study would just slot into, just add to the understanding of an already cohesive model of everything going on that boat. And it was really pivotal for me. And it helped me learn subjects later on, but especially we're jumping ahead, but I many times in my life been responsible for teaching others and even created a software developer bootcamp where I'm trying to make a well-rounded entry-level full stack developer. How do you accomplish that when there's so many individual different technologies to learn? And that principle is something we've applied to great success in that regard. So yeah, that was quite a moment.
Because what you're talking about is zooming in on one specific system, and maybe that's one specific piece of a technology that you need to learn. And then after you've zoomed in on it and studied it well, what you're talking about, your moment of clarity, is zooming out and seeing these interconnected concepts or pieces. Yeah. And seeing that bigger picture, sort of like moving from more of the concrete example problems we might do in a math book to understanding the high level conceptual idea.
Yes, the abstract.
That's how I took it.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because in my viewpoint, as an engineer, that balance of being able to determine the abstract principles behind a thing and then work with concrete implementations, that balance back and forth is really vital as an engineer. And obviously one of the most effective ways to teach an abstract is to first start with a concrete implementation and then back out of it. But I didn't know that. I wasn't able to articulate anything like that, like you did so well back when I was 18, 19 years old. But it's true, right? That is how it works. And it served me in great stead later on when I was actually working on a nuclear reactor, right? But it's also served me in great stead as I've taught others throughout my career. That's a great point.
Well, it seems like if you do it the other way, it's almost too hard. I mean, I'm sure that works for some people, right? I mean, it must work for some people. But if I give you this big abstract concept, it might be a little bit more difficult to figure out how to get from A to B. Whereas if I show you how to get from A to B, and that's an example of this kind of path, like a parallel circuit or a series circuit, whatever you want to call it, it's almost like those orders of operations and teachings line up a little bit better.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. And again, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but in our work in getting people into tech at a boot camp, this is something we've had to pay a lot of attention to, which is the balance between learning the theory of a thing and then the practical application of the theory. And if you don't keep those two things in balance, you can get out of whack pretty easily. I've had a lot of discussions with close friends who work in the academic area in computer science departments at universities and colleges. And it's a thing that, just because of the nature of how they can teach, it's been difficult for them to set up that practical balance. You know,
sure.
You get to a much deeper dive on the theory, but the practical can take a back seat. It's one of the reasons I love boot camps, but that's a discussion for later on.
Well, and you see the same thing with technical certifications, right? Just while we're here, we'll pause on that for a second. But this is very relatable to the technology certification that is learn the material, take the test, but there may not be a practical experiential arm that's part of the test. Not that you wouldn't do that to help yourself study, but you might not have to force yourself to do it to
right.
learn the things to pass the test. And then you have this maybe mismatch or handicap when you need to go and apply those things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's part of the reason that with certain rare exceptions when we're teaching people technology, copy and paste is not your friend at the beginning. Type it out, get your hands dirty. There's no better way to really get that understanding than to get your hands dirty and make it. Although actually there is one better way, teach it to someone.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah, you find out really quickly, wow, I didn't know as much as I thought I did.
Was the ability to teach something you landed on during your time in the Navy or something that you hit as a, oh, I can do this because I understand it now after you got out of the Navy?
That's a story I really wanted to be able to tell you because it happened in the Navy and I did not see it coming at all. So this is what I thought the career track was going to be in the Navy. As long as I only did the 6 years, I wasn't sure for a while whether I was going to go on longer. And ultimately I just did the 6 years, but I thought it would be 2 years of schooling and then 4 years on a boat. So I get done with the electronics school and did well, got done with the nuclear power school, top 10% of my class. I'm like, wow, I'm taken to this. It was a surprise to me. And then went to the nuclear prototype, the practical training, and nailed it. That's when everything came together. And there's two things I want to tell you out of that. I'll tell you the teaching one first. So I got picked up to be an instructor there. Out of every class that went through of 80 to 100 people, maybe one or two people got picked up to be an instructor. It was really, really cool. I'm like, oh, good. I'm going to be down in the boat helping take people through all these drills and get all this practical stuff done. And I started my first day and my boss, Chief Boston, Navy Chief is the ranking and his last name is Boston. So Chief Boston sits me down and says, so Eric, you're going to be a teacher. Wait, what? He says, yeah, we're going to put you in the classroom, give you a bunch of lesson plans, and you're going to draw up on the whiteboard and you're going to teach people. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not going to stand in front of people. First of all, I'm scared a lot at that. Second of all, I just graduated this program like yesterday, and I happen to know that the people you're going to throw me in with are only 4 to 6 months behind me. I'm nobody to them. Right? He says, that's your job. The Navy owns you. Do it. So I did not go into it thinking it was going to go well at all.
Yeah, low expectations.
Yes. But I'll tell you what, something happened about an hour into that first class. I don't get to talk about this a lot. I'd found my home. I didn't know that I had a gift for patience, for breaking down complex subjects, for paying attention to what's going on in the learner's mind, trying to grasp their point of view. And it just clicked and it came together. Now, I'm just realizing this as we're talking right now. Nick, I'd never even realized this. It's my dad. My dad is the most patient, effective teacher you could imagine. And I didn't realize until just now that that was just like channeling through me. So long story short, I fell in love with it. I absolutely fell in love with it. And I got to be part of a really cool program where we completely revamped the entire curriculum on that introductory part of the program before people go out and do all of their practical work. And that itself was a great experience. So there's that. That's how I came to teaching.
That's really cool.
The other story right in that period, I want to tell it because it led to them, I think, saying, hey, we'd like to offer you a position, is what happens in terms of panel interview at the end of this process. If you can picture this, you've got, again, Navy pace. So you're going 60, 70, 80 hours a week for 6 months of electronic school, 6 months of nuclear power school, and then up to 6 months of this nuclear prototype. And the end of that entire program, which is a pass fail, either you're going to make it or you're going to not, is an hour and a half to 2 hour long panel interview in front of three experienced nuclear reactor operators who've been in the program for 20 years or more. And they can ask you anything from the entire year and a half of education you just went through. I've experienced pressure at various points in my life. And sometimes that pressure has exceeded that hour and a half, but very few things come close. The reason I'm bringing this up is because when we're coaching people now on breaking into tech and what it's like to go through that interview, I have so much compassion and understanding that like it is nerve-wracking. I've never lost sight of it. And it is rather easy when you've been operating as a technologist for years to lose sight of what it's like at the beginning of your journey. But that part of it, I've never lost sight of. That is a nerve-wracking experience. And so anything I can do to help calm people down about that, give them the tools to be effective in it, how to handle questions that they don't immediately know the answer to, how to have a dialogue, how to communicate to the interviewers how you think, all of that stems from that one extremely stressful afternoon.
There are two things there that I heard we need to be empathetic about and remember We were all learners once and continue to be learners in some aspects. So we want to be mindful, as you said, of the learner's mind, where they are, how do we meet them where they are and help them get to where they need to be. But also for the interviewer, if you are someone who is interviewing people, surely you've been on the other side of the interview because there's no way you would be sitting in the seat you're in if you hadn't been. So hopefully you recall what it was like to be there and maybe you'll change your tactics a little bit to at least try to put the person on the other side of the table, figuratively speaking, at ease so that you can see who they really are and not the bundle of nerves that maybe we might end up being. Hopefully you'll get somewhere in between the bundle of nerves, yeah, can't think, and crushing it.
Yeah, that is a really good point. Any work you can do in any aspect of your life to be able to be willing to see something from another person's viewpoint is time well spent.
100%. And it's funny because you could hear it once and, you know, you heard it, but down the road sometime something happens and you think about that again and then it hits you. That's when, yeah, everything clicks. Just like you said, you saw the interconnected systems.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like the interconnected perspectives, if you will, help you formulate a different way forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I love taking people through that journey.
So what caused you to want to leave the Navy?
It's interesting. I was tired of working with machines. I mean, don't get me wrong. I worked with a lot of people and we had good teams, right? I was in what's called the Reactor Controls Division. We were responsible on the boat because I did 2 more years of instruction. Then the final 2 years were on a nuclear powered cruiser out of Bremerton, Washington. And all the way along, I'm working in a team, but the thing I'm working on, it's a reactor plane control panel. It's alarm and instrumentation equipment. And yes, I'm fascinated by that stuff. But ultimately, I wanted to move into something where I had more people interaction. And I didn't see that as part of the career trajectory. And as much as I, you know, was positive about the military, ultimately, I didn't want to do 20 years. So I decided to move out. And initially, I wasn't even going to go into technology at all. In fact, I went into sales for about 7 years after I got out. But technology kept creeping back into my life, which is another story. But yeah, that's why I left.
So how'd you feel about going into sales after not really having done that, unless I missed some experience there?
No, I didn't have any. Well, no, that's not true. That's not true. And in fact, look, we all have these moments in our lives that you look back in hindsight and you realize, wow, you grew up a little bit in that moment. I was in the Boy Scouts and they have a big event every year at a lot of Boy Scout troops called the Scoutorama, where they invite the public to come and see, you know, the fruits of our labors, the things we work on. You know, it's a public outreach thing for the Boy Scouts. Really cool things like building rope bridges and, you know, cool stuff. And it's also a big fundraiser for the troop. And so you can sell tickets to this Scoutorama. And I remember, like, it's 1983 or whatever, they were $5, which is not an insignificant amount of money, you know, $5 back in the day. I think minimum wage was $2.75 or something. And we ran a contest in the troop. Whoever sold the most tickets would get a Schwinn 10-speed bike. Now, I've already said we didn't have a lot of money. I didn't have a bike. I certainly didn't see a 10-speed in my future. And it just lit me on fire. And I found out that for the right motivation, I'm fearless. Now, that's not true. The fear is there, but I don't care. I knocked on so many doors, I can't even tell you. I grew up in a small town in Northern California. I probably knocked on well over 300 to 400 doors. I would stand out in front of Safeway for 3 to 4 hours sometimes after school or on the weekends, just selling Scoutorama tickets in my uniform, right? And at the end of the thing, I think number two was 530 tickets or something like that. I sold 888 tickets, 3/8, baby. I'll never forget that number. And I won a 10-speed. And that was my bike until I left and went in the Navy. So I'd had that experience and I never thought I'd come back to anything like sales. But as I was contemplating getting out, like, what am I going to do? That did come back to me. I'm like, I really liked that. I believed in what I was selling, was and still am passionate about the Scouts and what they meant to me, right? And the good they have for the community. I'm like, I think I could do this. So it was a big shift, but it was a shift that ultimately made a big change in my life, big improvement.
And how was the interview for that job after you had been through the panel interview in the Navy? Was it, did you prepare in the same way? Did you care as much? I'm just really curious about that.
No, this is great. This is the interview in giant air quotes. Okay, so I had actually gotten a sales job that I was just dying at, doing horribly, right? So picture this. It's 1994 and there's a company in Portland where I had settled that they had a really interesting business model that only existed for a brief moment in time, was very lucrative for that time period. What we would do is we would work with manufacturers of home improvement products, and we would create little infomercials for them and put them on an infinite loop videotape, and then ship a TV VCR player combination out to Home Depots and Lowe's and other, you know, retail places like that around the country. The store manager would put these things up on an end cap surrounded by the product, and they would just play on a loop, and they would sell these things. The company made bank for a while. They didn't hire me to sell that. I was a brand new young punk kid, hadn't got a lot of sales experience. What they hired me to do was to sell VCR tape duplication services. Oh man, can you feel the passion in my voice? Oh, I was so excited about it. Spoiler alert, I wasn't, and I stunk at it. So here I am, not doing very well at that, right? Not doing well at all. And a lady who helped get me the job, who was starting to be a really good friend, she said, "Hey, Eric, I don't know what you're doing this weekend, but my husband and his buddy have started up this little side business that's starting to pick up. They're selling sunglasses on the roadside, and they need someone to help man a booth for them and pick up a little extra money on the weekend." I'm like, okay, not doing anything else this weekend. Let's go do this. So I pull up to this 10 by 10 tent at a huge, busy intersection in Portland, Oregon. And it's got these trays out with sunglasses and these signs and everything. I'm like, this is an unusual activity. And I go in and I meet someone who ultimately became one of my best friends for life, John. And English fella, I'm not going to brutalize the accent. But he says, "Oh, it's nice to meet you. Let me show you what this is." And he shows me, this is how you sell and blah, blah, blah. Within a half an hour, I realized the entire course of my life changed. I fell in love with that activity. Never saw this coming at all. You get to meet person after person after person from all walks of life. You have a 2 to 5 minute sales cycle. You learn wonderful new things about people. They walk away super happy, and I was making bank. And so that's how it started. And for the next 7 years, that's what I did. I did it all over the Midwest. Lived in Hawaii and sold glasses there for a year and managed a bunch of people doing it. Went to Australia and sold sunglasses on the roadside. Went all over Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, like saw the country. Like it changed my life. I never saw that coming. So the interview process, British accent, here's how you sell sunglasses, start. And that was it.
Sort of an unstated trial period. It sounds like, oh, let's see what this guy can do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was pretty clear right away that I was going to take to that. It went really well.
And how was that experience the same or different from how you felt when you were teaching in the classroom at the Naval School?
You know, once I got to the point where I was a partner in the business and they started sending people out to wherever I happened to be selling to have me train them, it felt very, very similar. That same patience, you know, that same understanding of what it's like to be new to this. And especially this is a weird business. We call ourselves roadside warriors. This is a highly unusual activity to be involved in, is go to these towns for 7 to 10 days, sell as much as you can, and then up and move. And you have to do everything. You've got to find the location. You've got to talk to the owner of the property, get a contract with them, go to the building and zoning department, get licensed to be able to operate, set up, and then stay there for only a week or so, and then leave and do it again somewhere else, right? It's a very unusual activity. So they'd ship these people out and they're like shell-shocked, like, what have I done? I just bought all this stock and I've got a van now and I'm in the middle of Missouri. And so I had a lot of understanding for that, and the compassion helped me get them through that and then go off and kick butt and do really, really well. But teaching is teaching. You're adding value to the person. You're helping them accomplish their goals. And if you make it about them, you succeed. If you make it about how smart I am and being pedantic about it and like, no, you're doing it wrong, whatever, it isn't about them anymore and you're not going to win at it. So yeah, a lot of those same lessons came through.
It sounds to me like you just learned a new system.
Yeah, I did.
And all the logistics of everything and where you were going and the types of people you interacted with was a new system to learn.
Yeah, it all came through. You're absolutely right. That's a really good point. I hadn't actually kind of seen that. But yeah, it was that. And when it clicked, it clicked. It clicked really fast, which was surprising to me. So yeah, it came out of left field, man.
Now, does someone decide they want to stop doing this at the point where they enter into wanting to have a family or settling down? Because you eventually got out of that. So what caused you to want to do something different?
You're hitting the nail on the head. I already had a family. I got married young, had kids young, was in the Navy. It's pretty easy finance-wise to have kids while you're in the Navy. They phenomenal benefits, right? And so at this point, I had two, and then later on during that period, three boys. I would leave March 1st to go on the road, and come back around October. And I might fly home once or twice or three times during that period. It was brutal.
Oh, wow.
It was brutal. Now, you're making a good amount of money, but it's brutal on home life. Each year, my wife would be like, okay, that's it. We're done. This is the final season. And I'd try to move into some other career if we got something else I might enjoy. And then February would roll around and be like, I'm going to go clean up the van. And March 1st, I'd head out. And did that from 94 to 2000. And finally, summer of 2000, we're like, we're done. We're done. And I transitioned over and ended up, of all things, moving into flooring sales, which is a whole different chapter in my life. But yeah, that it's brutal time-wise. Tremendous lessons. I grew a lot during that period and got to experience a lot of cool things. It was the day after Christmas in 1995. I was in Hawaii. I've been operating all the company's facility, you know, salespeople out there for a year. And a couple of days before, my boss had said, hey, things are finally tapering off in Hawaii. So we're going to fly you to Sydney, Australia. So package up all of your stuff, all your equipment, your tent, your everything, and ship it to this address. And here's a plane ticket. December 26th, you're flying. I'm like, so I flew to Australia on December 26th. I didn't know anyone down there at all. By the end of the first night there, I had a really great place to live. The next morning, I had a van that I'd rented. And within 2 days, I had my sunglass stand set up and I was selling and bringing in money. You learn a lot about yourself when you get thrown into that kind of situation. You really do.
I mean, it almost sounds like you're a franchisee.
You very much were in a lot of senses in that particular business. At this point, I was starting to transition to being a bit more of a partner in the business because I was doing well at it and teaching a lot of people. But at that stage, yeah, it really was a kind of a franchisee thing. You're given a lot of independence on how you do things, but you have to conform to a lot of established, this is how we run the business. You get to keep the lion's share of the money and you could do really well.
Let's go back to the year after year conflict with your family and, okay, this isn't a good idea. It sounds like your wife kind of wanted you to stop because of family and being away from them. And eventually you got on board with this isn't a good idea. I think that kind of dynamic can play out with anybody in any job. You might think that what you're doing right now, dear listener, is not the greatest idea long term, but you haven't, something hasn't ignited, or what Dan Coyle calls ignition. You haven't made that decision or gotten the proper motivation to make the change. So just to break that down a little bit more of exactly what it took to decide to leave and do something else.
That's a really good question. I'm going back to the summer of 2000 because it was a summer like any other where halfway through we're like, this is it. We're doing okay, but this is the final one. And I don't know that there was any one single aha moment. But I looked at what I'd been doing and looked at, okay, where does this end? In fact, I do remember now that I was seeing some other people in our company who were in their 60s and they were still doing this. And as much as I enjoyed it, there were so many wonderful pleasure moments and meeting great people and getting incredibly comfortable with sales. I couldn't see myself doing that. It was this gradual shifting of that scale. You communicated that really well. And it just gradually shifted over. And so it wasn't a big, I've had enough and this is it. It was like, all right, now it's time for a change. And I suppose if I look internally, a part of what I've been struggling with was that every winter when I wasn't selling, I had tried to start something new, tried to figure out how do I shift out of this, and nothing had worked. It actually, I'm realizing it is an important thing that you brought up because flash forward now a decade and a half, no, 20, 25 years later, and I work with a lot with technology entrepreneurs. And that when you set out to start something and fail, especially if it's a side activity or whatever, you do that 2, 3, 4 times, man, and it can really hit you. And I tried that. I had tried appliance repair and I tried different sales things, DSL, digital subscriber link, for those of you who don't know, way to get, to get the internet, selling and installing those. So I didn't make it go right on any one of them. So as much as there's things I'm confident about, and I've grown a bit in that over the years, I wasn't that confident about a lot of things back in the time, especially making a significant change and relying utterly on myself to make it go right, to push through. And so I finally decided you got to do it. You got to do it. You have to pull that Band-Aid off and just make the change and trust that you've got enough mental toughness to transition to something.
And is the advice the same for the technology entrepreneur? Because I'm really curious about that. Special shout out to our listeners in Poland and Singapore for putting us on the Apple Podcast charts inside the top 200 podcasts in the business and careers categories. If the conversations we're having on Nerd Journey are valuable to you, dear listener, please consider rating us 5 stars, leaving a review, or sending us some constructive feedback to nerdjourneypodcast@gmail.com so we can improve the content for listeners like you. As you likely know, people leave jobs for a lot of reasons. Maybe it didn't turn out to be what you signed up for in the first place. Maybe it was a toxic culture or toxic environment or a horrible manager, or they never gave you a pay raise, or you didn't want to be on call all the time, or it was just too stressful and it was affecting the rest of your personal life. All those are legitimate reasons, and it could be many of those that were the reason you left. In Eric's case, it was an interesting type of work in that it was seasonal. So it was several months out of the year, but not every month of the year, where he worked as a salesperson selling sunglasses. It was certainly lucrative, but being away from a family with young children is definitely hard, especially for that many months out of the year. So there's a lot of pressure, a lot of challenges there. And then there's this issue of Eric and his wife knowing that the situation was not sustainable, but it took a while to make the decision to stop doing it, to stop continuing working like that. And it was really hard for Eric, especially after mentioning he had tried a number of different times to get into something else in the off season of selling sunglasses, but it didn't seem to pan out each time. The thing that seemed to give Eric the freedom to make the change finally was not only the pressures on his family and making that situation better, but it was looking at the future and the end state. He didn't want to be doing that job forever, for the rest of his career. He knew that there were other things that he might like to do or could do that were different than that and would be better for him and better for his family. So maybe having that future focus is something that each of us could think about when we're in a job and feel like we need to make a change. How much longer do we see ourselves doing this? Maybe that gives you some pause, and you may not have a clear plan or path forward or know what you need to do next. You might just know that you want things to be different. So you may need to talk to a peer, someone else in the industry, one of your professional contacts, maybe a mentor that you found, a trusted friend. Maybe you need to get a coach to just talk through what it is that you want to do, get some clarity on that, and then think about the steps you need to take to get there. We didn't get to hear the full story of what Eric did next, but don't worry, we'll get there as the story continues. I really love the idea of having compassion and empathy for people who are new to something. Eric has that for the learners when he was an instructor, having patience, remembering what it was like to be a student. He also has that for people going through interviews, people who go through the tech academy and go out to get that first tech job. He has a tremendous amount of compassion and empathy for them because he knows what it's like to have interviewed for your first job in a particular field. It can be mind-numbingly nerve-wracking, a lot of pressure. I hope that we can all remember what it was like to be new or be a beginner or be in a situation for the first time and be mindful of that when we encounter other people. Next week, we'll continue Eric's story, and we're going to talk about entrepreneurship and quite a bit about layoffs. We'll see you then.
Farewell, listeners. Tune in next time as the journey continues. I'm John White at B Journeyman, for Nick Cordy at Network Nerd _, signing off.
Adios.